Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Souls' weekly two-hour study of the Urantia Papers. We're seeking to grasp the fifth epical revelation in a synthetic wholeness. Tonight, paper 124. It's our arc, Jesus of Nazareth. The Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the distant shores rejoice. All who worship graven images are put to shame. Those who boast themselves of idols, worship him, all you gods. Psalm 97. I'm Brad Garner. So glad that you're here with us live or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. It's a considerable archive. You should check it out if you haven't yet. With us tonight, Dr. Chris Halverson, David Tucker, Justin Armstrong, and you. Won't you join us in our study of this epical revelation to our world? We sure need it. Call up the text as you please and take a seat with us. Hello there, Dr. Chris.
Hello, Brad. Well, one might almost guess that we're going to touch upon the subject of graven images tonight. Thanks for that great quote. Hello to you, Justin, and you, David, and everyone listening in, whether live or in the can, as they say. As Brad was pointing out, we're ready to shift gears a little bit to the next phase of Jesus' young life. And he keeps on his very aggressive, precocious course, as we'll discover. And the more sophisticated his mind gets, the more complex it is to find a way to conform it with the world without the world just having a total cow about it. Not to mix religions there. We are in Palestine, not India. It's just an endlessly fascinating journey, and we'll see that a number of themes that we got started with in the earlier part of his childhood just continue forward. The Brevelager is giving us all kinds of amazing little vignettes. All right, so hope everyone enjoys the journey as we continue on with Jesus' later childhood.
Yes, the later childhood of Jesus. And we're looking forward to it. There's, like you say, a lot going on in his mind, but a lot that we can still glean from it that's relevant to us today. That's what we do here on Symmetry of Soul. We try to bring these teachings to life and into the present and make sense of them in a living way. And David, good evening to you. How are you doing, sir?
Howdy, Brad. Hello, Dr. Chris. Hello, Justin, and everybody listening. I'm doing just well. Very good. Had a great day, and these are my favorite papers now. They're as you say, things that I can apply to my daily living right now. And I feel like a lot of what the master learned early on in these years are very much applicable to me in my current state and on my personal journey. So very excited to be here and very grateful for all of you.
All right. Glad to hear that they're rocketing up the charts, you know, your top 50, your top 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Similarly here, they're making more sense to me now that I've lived a fair bit in life and have the prospect of parenthood.
Yeah. When Jesus said, enter the kingdom as a little child, he should have, you know, comma, consider my life. Course it wasn't until now that we have that life to reflect upon. What a blessing.
Very much so. Justin, good evening to you. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well. Good evening, Brad. Good evening, Dr. Chris, and good evening, David. I have a 9-year-old daughter who's about to turn 10 in a little over a month, so I'm really, really grateful to be here studying Jesus' 9th and 10th year with everyone this evening.
Oh, very, very trenchant, very relevant material. Well, let's see, before we commence with things tonight, let's see where we were last week. I had the summary duties here, so I will try to kindle our minds a bit here. So before we started the reading last week, we talked about striving against material gravity using spirit gravity, the tension between material and spirit gravity. You see, material gravity always wants to level you down. It's nothing personal, literally. What it does to mountains, it would do to you. Material gravity is founded on the Isle of Paradise, which is an absolute. So one absolute can only be overcome with another absolute. We must choose God, that level of absoluteness, that personality choice to overcome material gravity. With a spirit nucleus and inner life, I can maintain cosmic poise in the face of challenges. With a spirit nucleus, I can be wise even when the going gets tough. With a spirit nucleus, I can become the observer of that anxiety that's surging around in me as a part of my material origins. And though I can't eliminate it, I can abandon it, leave it behind by going up into that spirit nucleus and seeking the kingdom of heaven there. But I must always remember, my soul is in my free will hands. Your soul is in your free will hands too. Even God cannot overrule free will. My inner life free will is so powerful and sovereign that I could exalt animal anxiety into my inner life if I willed it. That would poison my inner life. And once that poison were to be in there, it's not easy to get rid of it. In fact, it would somehow follow me to the afterlife, even if we don't fully understand how. Vigilance is the price we must pay for such a gift as free will. Vigilance with our inner lives. Okay, then the reading. We continued in Section 5, School Days in Nazareth. We observed that by age 7, Jesus is having human experiences. He's an active and questioning self, generating reflective questions. His questions are not mere animal instinct-driven curiosity, and even cats are curious, nor are they those clever animal machination questions kids are infamous for. Eat your dinner. But why? No, these are questions born in the higher levels of mind. We can say this confidently because the adults around Jesus were being led upward by and learning from Jesus' questions. Jesus was intensely scientifically curious. He was intrigued by the landscape and the night sky, that's geography and astronomy, and he wanted causal explanations for it all. Nature and her various moods supplied plenty of material for an active and questioning self. His reverent and sympathetic contact with nature allowed his sixth adjutant mind spirit to find expression, and this was grown into higher things, worship, compassion, and so forth. Those literal jaunts to physical overlooks he took with his father, they encouraged Jesus' mind to view all matters from a higher vantage point. All of these experiences served to progressively strengthen his connection with the three cosmic intuitions. The purpose of education is to sharpen this connection. You see, science and religion need one another. We say it here often. Science and religion need one another. Jesus' scientific curiosity was balanced by religious education through stories and learning the law and scriptures. Never underestimate a young child's ability to store up scripture and stories in their memory that can serve them well for a lifetime. Jesus selected Isaiah 61 as his birthday text, and what do you know? It got ingrained at a young age and became a recurrent motif throughout his life and throughout his preaching. It was his touchstone. How many of us today received a balanced scientific and religious education as children? Well, I can certainly report attending Sunday school in childhood, but only in fits and starts, and I can report that it seemed boring and dead to me. Meanwhile, my scientific education was less of true science and more about random factoid cataloging and reciting. We can do better than this for our children in the light of an epical revelation, and this story of Jesus' childhood can help be a guide to us. We considered the liberality of Galilee and Nazareth and how it allowed Jesus' curiosity to flourish. Liberty originates in the inner life. In the outer life, there is that which is liberal, liberty-like outward expressions of inner life liberty. Things like freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of movement. A liberal education, in the classic sense, examines many lines of thought, but then helps the student get above all of them. From that high vantage point, the student examines them all with top-down cosmic intuition to reflectively discern truth within them. But please do take care. Truth is not just what feels naturally pleasant to you based on your genetics. Common misconception. And also take care, liberality can be overplayed. All good things taken to an extreme become bad. Being overly liberal, one might consort with evil and sin. Or being overly liberal, one might even support illiberality in the name of liberality. Or might even fall into the pit of the religion of skepticism. Now, liberality must be bridled, kept in check with respect to the cosmos. Then section 6, Jesus' 8th year. We see Jesus started out life as a human boy, not a magic fetish boy and his magical doings. Overall, he was not an unusual boy. He did well in school, but was not the top of his class. It is, however, a curious coincidence that a math teacher crossed paths with him and helped further refine his analytical faculties. And he also began to like music, and this was encouraged in his culture. All these things are continuing examples of just why Nazareth was an ideal place to grow up for Jesus. We saw Jesus becoming a teacher as soon as he could, teaching the alphabet to his brother James, just as soon as James had the capacity. And even though he had natural gifts as a teacher, Jesus, this is not unusual in and of itself. Teaching those a little bit behind us is a cosmic pattern we are all destined to experience. And then this paper 123 ends with this urbane, sophisticated religious teacher from Jerusalem traveling to Nazareth and making a case for Jesus to return with him and enter something akin to a junior boarding school. This is not necessarily extraordinary. Even today in our world, many children go to school far from their home village. This teacher, though, was not prepared for Jesus being such an impressively reflective human at age 8. Jesus, at age 8, spoke with frankness about his understanding of the world, an understanding balanced between the scientific and the religious. Can we do the same in the light of an ethical revelation? And here ends the summary.
Fantastic job, Brad.
Yeah. Really well done.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brad. I have to say it though. It's almost impossible for me to divorce one word from the other in paper 16, section 6, you know, and just say sharpen those three cosmic intuitions, develop and sharpen.
We can never leave keywords like that out. Yeah. I added that one in on the fly, so I lost my precision in the moment.
It's okay, you know, just one has to be careful not to turn these into platitudes either, you know, where all you can do is just, you know, recite them verbatim, but you have no reflective relationship to them. But nonetheless, I bring it up because, of course, we're in this very early mode where, you know, he's starting with basically nothing in the way of insight, and he has to develop that insight first, and then sharpen it. The develop part is very relevant to the stage we're in here. And as we were talking at the beginning, if you're just beginning to respond to trying to enter the kingdom as a little child, no matter what your age, recognize that step one is to develop something that you didn't know existed, and that will kind of be part of that entrance into the kingdom, a little bit of development of that insight. You know, after all the basic physics of how you can achieve a faith grasp is via the insight of the third cosmic intuition. So there has to be, you know, some little bit of development there that you are, exercising for the first time. And then that long process of sharpening those, eventually culminating in being born again, at the heights of that sharpening.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent point. Thanks for augmenting, clarifying, amplifying, whatever you want to call that there. It is always a temptation to quote platitudes. We have several dozen of them here on Symmetry of Soul that come up often. I can notice quite easily. I can rattle off preconceived opinions, and then everyone else can finish the rest. It's important to keep them living, lest they become like campaign slogans or things you say during the fifth epical revelation rosary recitation. Like that, we can do better than that.
Yes, it is sad to record that we know all those, right?
One of the tricky things about turning things into platitudes like that, you don't recognize that it's probably an unwitting but nonetheless psychological procedure of abstracting the challenge within yourself. Yes. Do I have preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding mm-hmm. prejudices? No, that's an abstracted thing that I lay out over the world out there. It isn't immediately relevant to me. The only point of taking note of those is to apply them to yourself. That's what the courageous word is about, again, in Paper 16, Section 6.
Yeah, I was going to just share that right before you said it about the preconceived opinions. What I've noticed is as I'm willfully developing these my cosmic insights, and especially the first, I'm getting more insights into things that I've misapplied spirit to, things that I've developed as a preconceived opinion, settled idea, longstanding prejudice. It's like more of that is being revealed to me. I recognize it. And I immediately go, okay, well, now we know what to do with that. It doesn't belong there. I don't know exactly what does belong there, but I know this doesn't. So I'm going to actively take that out. It's now part of my personality management that I'm aware of, and I just do not allow my mind to go in that direction any longer. And if it does, I promptly admit it and then do my best to steer clear of it the next time. And I'm getting stronger. It's like lifting a muscle, but for your spirit. The more you do it, you're fortifying this. I wanted to share that, but you already had said it. So, that's very relevant to me.
Yeah, and again, it's so much more than a platitude in reality. Those preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, that is your concept brain. They control every thought you have. Every thought you have. Those who want to control you see to it that they get into your life early and author your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices. Okay? And so, that concept frame controls you, and they control the concept frame, therefore they control you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those old wise things.
And they're out there saying, well, those religious teachers are trying to give them a religious concept frame. And, well, I'm a relativist, so that's just a competing concept frame. So instead of them coming for my children, I'm going to go after their children or whatever. And it becomes this war of supposedly equal and relative warring concept frames. And it's just Nietzsche's will to power. Who can shout the loudest? But in reality, there's one concept frame that is relatively true, and the rest are false. The religious one.
And when you
bring up in it, go ahead, Justin.
I was just going to touch on that reference to true, because when you bring up true worship, not merely just the beginning stages of insight into this third cosmic intuition, but there's a wholeness reciprocally on the other side of the equation, where it references that sincere worship connotes the mobilization of all the powers of the human personality under the dominance of the evolving soul and subject to the divine directionization of the associated thought adjuster. So there's also a wholeness to true worship, sincere worship.
Yeah, and again, like I said, how important it is to think of of those preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, not in some simplistic linear fashion, but in a holistic way, so that they literally encompass your mind.
Yeah.
You know, and hence, are the predicate for every thought, every conclusion. And you're quoting there, they're speaking of that wholeness. The part is always going to be subject to the whole, and you've been given free will. That innately encompassing influence of your personality, because of its transcendence to reality itself, means that you are in total control of how your mind is framed. And when you're very young, you just have no idea that you wield such a consequential influence upon yourself.
Yeah.
But those that want to manipulate you do. They know if they can get you to consecrate your will to their will, they have not part of you, they have all of you. And that's why, it's so consequential. If they're wicked and they have all of you, well, then the blind follow the blind into the pit. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just very important to understand, because you have this personality, the sweeping consequences of your ill will. Aren't just partly messing yourself up. You're holistically messing yourself up. So,
speaking of wicked,
it's that whole mustard seed thing that Jesus tried to talk about. It's what the revelators talk about when they get you to think about the difference between geometric and arithmetic. Exercising your will has geometric consequences. An embryonic soul of goodness can be overwhelmed quickly.
Mentioning a reoccurring theme that I think we've been touching on through Friday night and Symmetry of Soul has been the secularist abhorring ignorance and the religionist abhorring iniquity. And it's been said enough times that it was just present in my mind for the last couple of weeks a lot. And I just have been able to recall how often that was a part of me, this sort of sense of self-righteousness and pride development with learning and having information or knowledge that you could kind of dangle over others. And I very much misapplied that. And however, the last couple of weeks, I've had some really beautiful thoughts that I can't take credit for, but I can only just give credit that the Holy Spirit must have recognized some sense of humility in me enough to give me the grace and give me these thoughts, because I would recognize when I would normally, a natural response would be for me to scoff at someone because of intellectual ignorance or to poke fun of them. And I would catch myself, especially this last week, and I would just say, no, that's unacceptable, not going to happen. And I'm going to be looking for iniquity. That's where I'm going to point my finger at. And it's not going to be someone not understanding something just because I might have been blessed with a certain amount of knowledge in a given subject. And it's been really impactful for me. So I'm really grateful that on Friday nights and Tuesday nights, we have these gems and that they begin just showing up in your mind unexpectedly. And you're like, oh my God. And you recognize, That wasn't me. I didn't originate that. Or perhaps there's the best part of me was capable of recognizing that and then complying with it. And it feels good. It feels so good to recognize that. And then you just give gratitude. You give thanks. When I'm in my daily prayers, I do that. Oh, thank you so much, Father, for bringing that into my mind. It had no business in there naturally. And here it is, and I'm grateful for it. So I just love that we share this. And Chris, that you do such a wonderful job of just being patient with us, because as often as I ask you questions, and probably many of them have been repetitive, and there you are with just some patience and humility, and you still share it with us. So I'm just so grateful for all of us and this time that we have together.
Well, thank you very much. And you know, and it's the most important thing is, you know, bringing an end to any of this sort of, you know, knowledge-based self-righteousness. As a student of the Revelation, don't teach your children to skip down the street, you know, saying, "I know about Omnifem and you don't."
Right.
You know, it's a very unfortunate influence that a parent can easily pass to their children. Right? I mean, they pick up on that like little sponges. When you have that, that knowledge elitism like that. And it does great damage to their souls.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's just no need to give a little 9-year-old, I'll think about a 9-year-old boy, more things to try to boast on the schoolyard about and try to pick fights over. Random factoids that boys are prone to memorizing. I mean, try to foster a living connection to spirit ministries in these kids, and you don't have to do that with recitation of dead formulas and creeds. That's part of it, but you don't lead with that. You know, there are definitely things people ought to recite and some things that kids ought to commit to memory, but don't lead with that and say you're special, more special than all the other kids on the schoolyard because you have arcane knowledge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it's not the, you know, that dead knowledge. The point is not the knowledge itself. It's what you do with it. Is it living within you? You know, and supplying the touchstones along the path of truth, you know, as opposed to just being as exalted as an end in itself.
Indeed. Well, anything else on anyone's mind? Anything brought up by the review you want to talk about?
No, once again, well crafted, Brad. Thank you much.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. It's a joy to get to put those together. So, I think I've done it before. I'll say it again. That would be a fine exercise for any listener to try to do. Or if you don't have to listen to Symmetry of Souls. See if you can read a section of the Urantia Papers and then rewrite it in a paragraph form in your own words. See if you can grasp some of these things for yourself, or at least answer the question, what was the most important thing in that section? Those sorts of learning techniques, those reflective techniques. They take a lot of time, but I just can't imagine something more valuable than engaging with an epical revelation in that way. We don't have it here as a personality. This epical revelation is a book. So writing and reciting exercises are kind of they're going to be par for the course here a lot. So
yeah, the person reading is the person of that's intimate with the revelation for good or for ill.
Yeah, for good or for ill. Yeah,
you don't have the good personality of Melchizedek of Salem or Jesus of Nazareth or whatnot, you know, before you. You're the person. Are you up to being a person of revelation?
If not, you will probably see something else there in the Urantia book, something that causes you to file it next to, you know, UFO religion, cults, and dolphin worship, or next to, like, channeled works and other ephemera. It's not
a
big thing.
Or just lots and lots of pages that affirm everything about yourself.
Well, yeah, your UFO religion, your dolphin worship, whatever, you know. Yeah, stuff you like.
Yeah, that's such an enriching process. I find myself challenging by listening in the PHI library to a paper that I know runs counter to my nature. You know, for instance, I'm very heavily Unity biased, and so sticking my attention at a particular paper that I know is more geared towards individuality and specifics is challenging. So, like, I like pushing myself and sitting with it longer than I know that I would naturally walk away from or tune myself out or something of that nature, and just trying to build that resistance, like almost like muscle training, you know, like pushing it a little bit past where I know it's comfortable. And then the next time I come and I find I've got a little bit more that I can sit through and a little bit more that I can pull attention into. And it's like working a muscle. It's really what it's like.
Yeah. That takes us right into, you know, the reading. You know, we'll see Jesus just been picking up right where we left him, and doing just exactly that, getting ever more comfortable with tightly focusing in on precise details, so that he isn't just someone who's going to be stimulated, you know, to fuzz out into a mystical bliss. You know, there has to be something that is of equal energy in your mind to balance the sixth adjutant. The fourth adjutant, you know, has to take on the sixth and prevent the sixth from dominating and fuzzing your mind out.
That's a little David versus Goliath there.
But they're on the same level, see?
Yeah,
it doesn't appear that the fourth could do it, you know, especially if you just call it the fourth and, you know, well, the sixth has got to be dominant. But you're, you know, the grace of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit has put the fourth, fifth, and sixth on the same plane, on the second level of meaning. The fourth, you know, is up to it now. You know, in a human, it can balance that sixth. Yeah. So your scientific impulse can be just as strong as your religious impulse. If anything, we're noticing that the revelator, you know, the midwares, and talking about Jesus' young life, it's like, well, they seem to be focusing mostly on the strength of his scientific impulse, his fourth adjutant.
Yes. Yeah.
Not his sixth.
When you put it that way, that is rather striking. He's going to a synagogue school that is a religious education, and he's Jesus, and yet we're getting all these paragraphs about the weather and, you know, and looking out over landscapes. And, fascinating.
And why are, you know, stars different colors? And, on and on the questions go.
Yeah. Huh.
You know, why is that star green and that one's orange?
And they do balance that as well with those little references to just a little conversation with my father.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about that faith side in the context of the culture he's in and the study that he's engaged in, it's not merely the acceptance of those preconstructed theology. It's the living a dynamic mode in which he's developing a realization or divine fellowship with the presence of God in his inner life. That's what that mode of faith entails when he's having those conversations with the Father. So even though there's little reference to the specificity of the development of that faith, they are hinting at it. They are hinting at that symmetry.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You can, again, it's, you know, the midwares know that their audience is likely to not have issues with minimizing Jesus's religious nature.
Yeah.
Okay. But they do most likely have issues with minimizing his scientific nature.
Yes.
And they're trying to, you know, give us a presentation to balance us out. Yeah. So again, you know, the assumption that's being made of the audience. Well, everyone reading this book knows the Bible like the back of their hand, and, you know, and are very religious themselves and have, you know, if anything, an overplayed sense of the religiosity of Jesus, and therefore, yeah. But, you know, again,
yeah.
Are any of those assumptions valid in an ever more secularized potential audience?
It's very interesting. It makes me wonder if Jesus had a bias. You can't tell because you can see this balanced approach to all things. But I wonder.
Well, they pointed out that, you know, the imbalance was, you know, the dichotomy was embedded in his parents.
Right.
That's one of the first topics that's going to come up tonight. You know, he, you know, was bequeathed sort of half and half, right? And, you know, and it helped him to get a sense of his own internal balance by just reflecting upon the back and forth between his parents.
That was a fine selection that was made for his earth parents, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's get going here. It's paper 124 of the Urantia Papers, The Later Childhood of Jesus. And we're in page 1366 of the original single column publication, if that's how you like to roll. Although Jesus might have enjoyed a better opportunity for schooling at Alexandria than in Galilee, he could not have had such a splendid environment for working out his own life problems with a minimum of educational guidance, at the same time enjoying the great advantage of constantly contacting with such a large number of all classes of men and women hailing from every part of the civilized world. Had he remained at Alexandria, his education would have been directed by Jews and along exclusively Jewish lines. At Nazareth, he secured an education and received a training which more acceptably prepared him to understand the Gentiles, and which gave him a better and more balanced idea of the relative merits of the Eastern, or Babylonian, and the Western, or Hellenic, views of Hebrew theology.
So before we get into the specifics there of this opening paragraph, you know, let's remind ourselves of the you know, of the big picture of the arc that we're going through. We've you know, just finished that first phase, that first developmental phase, where, you know, he's 3 years old, but you know, less than 8 years old. You know, greater than or equal to 3 and less than 8. Now we're in the next phase, the later childhood, where he's, you know, greater than or equal to 8 all the way up to less than 12. Right, so that next phase, we're entering in on, and we're looking at how they, you know, present the differential of, you know, what's going on, you know, up to 8 relative to what can begin to happen. You know, hence we begin this journey here, and yeah, and like I said, see, right up front, notice that final statement about him being able to reflect on the back and forth amongst the Jews between, you know, the traditional, you know, as the Jewish leaders founded things and reworking Hebrew history and, you know, laying down the Hebrew scriptures, you know, beginning with the exile in Babylon, you know, and so that sort of found, as it was founded, sort of official religious theology, in contrast to what began to percolate into that, post-Alexander the Great, during those three Hellenistic centuries, the first three centuries B.C., and so you get this modification, and notice what they're saying before that in the earlier part of the paragraph. Again, all of these external stimuli that allow him to not get stuck in just a very basic, merely religious nucleus. Just a mere born again and then kind of crystallized state. But that Greek influence, right, is bringing in a philosophic overlay of sophistication that can provide the beginning template for someone who's born again beginning the journey towards being born again, becoming a religionist of philosophic attainment. And so, they keep emphasizing how important his environment was, not just to get him religiously founded, but to have that still be liberty in that inner domain, that can roll upward into someone who eventually gets right to fusion.
Is that playing off of that, Chris? Is that, I almost tripped when reading the minimum of educational guidance. It's a strange phrase. I feel like that's rife for misinterpretation. Oh, so no educational guidance? No, a minimum. Maybe what they're saying is as simple as possible, but no simpler. One of those sorts of things.
All good things taken to extreme become bad. That's what they're referring to, right? Religious guidance, yes, but not overly so, because then it becomes a net negative.
Yeah.
Right? Because then you're just boxing them in into this tiny little space that few are able to break out of, as they continue to biologically mature. They get stuck in this little concept frame. Right. We have these incredibly raw horsepower, brilliant individuals on the planet right now that are trapped in these minuscule concept frames, just extremely primitive concept frames.
And they
construct elaborate schemes within those little frames, so elaborate that most people can't even follow them, but it's all irrelevant because it's so tiny, Yeah, they think they're not ignorant, but really they are.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like something that the revelators refer to as pathetic.
Yes.
I think that's because that third level of religious philosophy is like, boy, you've got a lot going on there, but you're trying to jam it into a thimble-sized worldview with one simple prevailing unifying notion in it that's materialistic. You're a slave to that idea. Yeah, you have no freedom.
It's just painful. Once the revelation, opens your mind up to the real cosmos, to try to put yourself back in the little frame that some, five PhD brilliant guy, is in that, you're listening to a YouTube video of, it's like, oh my Lord. I mean, it's just so painful. I mean, his thoughts philosophically are so trivial, and yet, he's 1,000 times more intelligent than I am.
And this picture of starting with that religious foundation and then moving into that more philosophical mode, you could think about that specifically in this first preface in the context of Jesus's direct experience, but you could also think about it as the spear point of Western civilization in the beginnings of Christianity, as they point out in 195, section 1, the influence of the Greeks. there's this little quick section where they say, Christianity came into existence and triumphed over all contending religions primarily because of two things. One, the Greek mind was willing to borrow new and good ideas, even from the Jews. And two, Paul and his successors were willing but shrewd and sagacious compromisers. They were keen theologic traders. So you have the synthesis of both sort of the East and the West at the beginning of the emergence of Christianity's influence on Western civilization. So you can see it in the macro picture as well as just this personal experience that Jesus is having.
Yeah, and there's two phases of the Hellenization. I mean, yeah, first you have the Hellenization of Judaism, and then subsequently you have a further Hellenization of Christianity.
Yeah.
So it becomes a very, very huge influence. Yeah, but another important point besides what rolls forward, but what the predicate is for them bringing this up, like I said up front, his parents. Recall that in the paper before we started our arc, in paper 122, if you look at on page 1349, the last little paragraph of section 5, there in paper 122, remember that simple little statement about this polarity, right, between his parents. Joseph held vigorously to the Eastern or Babylonian views of Jewish religion. Mary leaned strongly toward the more liberal and broader Western or Hellenistic interpretation of the law and the prophets.
Yeah, it's right there.
Okay. And so, we're about to see Joseph's vigorousness, right, play out here. It's like, no, we're not going to, use our imagination to interpret the Ten Commandments in a more allegorical fashion. No, we're going to interpret them very straightforward and literally, because he held vigorously to the Eastern or Babylonian view, right, of the Jewish religion. And he's going to lay down the law, as it were, right, because, of his sensibility to that there's some things you shouldn't be squishy about. And that's, it's important, see, in this process of this Hellenization, it's you're opening up, that active and questioning self, yes, but you can't let it get at your unquestioning loyalty nucleus.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. And that, of course, is that concern underlies all of the Jewish religious authorities, right? I don't know about this Hellenistic influence here. And it's like, well, they have a point, right? It could easily, because of its sophistication, relative to ancient Jewish texts, the Hebrew texts, right? Because of its sophistication, it could easily, get at and corrupt the religious nucleus of unquestioning loyalty. Right, in the midst of such vigorous questioning.
And as Brad referenced in the review the multiple times, this spirit nucleus, when they directly reference it in 196.3, the very final section of the book, they specifically state that there's a spirit nucleus in the mind of man, the adjuster of the divine presence. They're making it very clear that sort of that's a predicate to everything that you're focusing on and when you use that term spirit nucleus.
Yeah. Again, you can gain the world by questioning, right? But the soul is founded on unquestioningness. Right? And so you must be careful not to lose your soul.
Right. That's the pit of skepticism I alluded to that you can fall into. That was very much a part of the tradition coming out of Athens. You know, just once you see enough philosophies and you think, well, you know, what is truth, said Pontius Pilate. You say, well, then I doubt the whole thing.
Again, it's very important, you know, for someone as precocious as Jesus to have an immovable rock for one of his parents that lay, you know, and all of a sudden done, he lays down the line, like, no, you know, here we stand. You know?
Yeah.
There is no wiggle room.
That's certainly something.
Our unquestioning loyalty, our faith nucleus is in play.
That speaks very much to our times. Those kinds of definitive parenting techniques are in the main not celebrated these days. They're seen as, inflexible, rigid, old school, callous. You could pick any number of supposedly negative adjectives. They're certainly not the fashion now. And you don't want to overplay them. Yeah, you can just become what kind of moralist, a colorless ascetic. You can become a pretty grim person, but in proper proportion, it just lays down some important boundaries.
Yeah, and if if you're like we were talking about up front, you know, if you're fundamentally abhorring intellectual ignorance, you look at someone's so-called supreme values and you properly judge them to be base or even false. Yeah. But if you throw those out, you lose your soul. Right? So that's the tricky part here about gaining some intellectual sophistication. Can you maintain your soul? No, God will take care of it. It's fine. No, you have free will. It's absolutely in your hands. No one can save it but you. So that's one of the very key truths that's flowing through Jesus' upbringing here that very much, like you're saying, Brad, applies today. How to raise a child that's an active and questioning self, but not to the point where that good thing is taken to an extreme and becomes bad and he loses his soul.
Right. Yeah. That's the art. Section 1, Jesus' ninth year, AD 3. Though it could hardly be said that Jesus was ever seriously ill, he did have some of the minor ailments of childhood this year, along with his brothers and baby sister.
The one thing I always chuckle when I read this, like, well, what about his older sister?
Right.
She had a great immune system or something, or what's the deal there? Anyway, I'm not sure what to make of that, where the midway has expressed that there. Again, obviously, an underlying point is he's not some little magic boy, somehow got, a full Adamic uplift and is now immune to all viruses and, malicious bacteria.
No, there's a place, it's probably before we started reading here, and early in part 4, where they say he was a man of his day. He had a mind of a first century man. He had the body of a first century man. Like, they all but say, the thing that he was doing then wouldn't work in the 21st century at all. He was just a man of his time.
Or as I, always point out, you could take that all the way to the extreme of, imagining taking Jesus of Nazareth literally out of his context 2,000 years ago and trying to plop him on a world settled in light and life. If they would even allow your ship to approach the planet, it'd be amazing. But if you did land, they would immediately seal you in a hermetically sealed bubble. Because, you know, he then, us now. I mean, we're just, you know, utterly degenerate and defective, you know, biologically relative to those people.
And yet, a planet that's in light and life very much wants to read this story of their creator son incarnating, because the truths that he taught are eternal and timeless, even if they came through the lens of intellectual ignorance in a tribe of people in the desert long ago on some distant world. No, the truths are eternal and transcendent.
Yeah, not to mention they marvel at, it's like, well, you know, in light and life, I can think about how I do mind over matter, but, you know, it's a small feat. The mind over matter that Jesus did. Now there is something to tell stories about.
Right. School went on, and he was still a favored pupil, having 1 week each month at liberty, and he continued to divide his time about equally between trips to neighboring cities with his father, sojourns on his uncle's farm south of Nazareth, and fishing excursions out from Magdala.
Again, they just, you know, sort of over and over and over again, you know, it almost becomes curious. It's like, wow, they are very much stressing this diversity of experience, you know. He's not bottled up in a little, you know, insular space in Alexandria. He's not even bottled up in a little insular space in Nazareth or, they're just constantly stressing the importance of not just having an active and questioning self, but having the interplay with an active and external world of great diversity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I remember reading this particular paragraph at a particularly young age in my life, you know, double digits, but barely, because I was finally able to read it. And, chafing at the fact that, well, Jesus got 25% of his time off from school. Why don't I? And you know, the problem is, if I think back on it, I know exactly what I was thinking. I mean, I can hear the Super Mario Brothers theme playing right now. I would not have used my time well. I would have not been guided into constructive channels with 25% free time at liberty.
Yeah, you would have shoved yourself down into a smaller space.
Right.
Instead of expanding yourself out into a bigger space, yes.
Yeah. That would be the challenge today. People, you know, this is a paragraph to not naively overplay, I think, if you're raising kids. Well, okay, 25% free time. Okay, we're going to negotiate that with the school. That, well, you know, slow down, cowboy. What's that 25% free time looking like? What's it being done? You know, done with it. And the answer better not be screen time or video games or whatever else that's not a mindful, cosmic intuition developing and sharpening tool, you know, the pursuit.
Yeah, I think I heard recently, you know, a recent survey of, you know, the average child spends 8 hours a day, you know, in social media.
Well, there you go. That's more than 25%. How's that working out for them? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The most serious trouble as yet to come up at school occurred in late winter, when Jesus dared to challenge the Chazan regarding the teaching that all images, pictures, and drawings were idolatrous in nature. Jesus delighted in drawing landscapes, as well as in modeling a great variety of objects in potter's clay. Everything of that sort was strictly forbidden by Jewish law, but up to this time he had managed to disarm his parents' objection to such an extent that they had permitted him to continue in these activities.
Joseph said yes, dear.
That has to be it.
Remember the predicate. Yeah, what's going on here, right? Like I tried to highlight there at the beginning. I wonder if this is why Brad brought up graven images at the beginning. Yep, here it is, right up front.
Here it is. Yeah. I was thinking, there is another place. It appears that Jesus, he wasn't having machinations of a kid, but he really could disarm his parents. Like, why do we kiss the, the thing every time we walk through the door. Isn't that such and such? And like he could just keep asking the question until finally they're like, all right, we'll take it down. they couldn't come up with good answers sometimes. So yeah, but we're about to read. I think that there was a very vivid thing that's about to happen that his dad just couldn't overrule. Yeah. So the trouble was again stirred up at school when one of the more backward pupils discovered Jesus drawing a charcoal picture of the teacher on the floor of the schoolroom. There it was, plain as day, and many of the elders had viewed it before the committee went to call on Joseph to demand that something be done to suppress the lawlessness of his eldest son. And though this was not the first time complaints had come to Joseph and Mary about the doings of their versatile and aggressive child, this was the most serious of all the accusations which had thus far been lodged against him. Jesus listened to the indictment of his artistic efforts for some time, being seated on a large stone just outside the back door. He resented their blaming his father for his alleged misdeeds. So, and he marched, fearlessly confronting his accusers. The elders were thrown into confusion. Some were inclined to view the episode humorously, while one or two seemed to think the boy was sacrilegious, if not blasphemous. Joseph was nonplussed, Mary indignant, but Jesus insisted on being heard. He had his say, courageously defended his viewpoint, and with consummate self-control, announced that he would abide by the decision of his father in this, as in all other matters controversial. And the committee of elders departed in silence.
Once again, we see how important honor your father and your mother, that commandment is.
Yeah.
You know, in the founding of Jesus. Because, after all, think about it. Without that bedrock element that he would fall back on, are you raising a child? Is Jesus a child that is going to mature into an individual of real faith? Founded on following God's instructions, following the capital F Father's instructions. If he won't follow the lowercase F Father's instructions.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's just, you can begin to understand how important it was to have that commandment in there. Lest the child have no predicate for faith.
Well,
I got into a bit of a disagreement with my wife today in regards because I drive the speed limit and not 1 mile over the speed limit any longer. And she was like, why are you driving so slow? And I said, well, I'm really doing my best to follow the law. And I know it's irritating, but, you got to trust me. Like, there's a good reason for this. And she said, well, it's stupid. Everyone else is driving fast and for at least faster, you can at least go 5 miles over the speed limit. And I said, how am I ever supposed to be trusted to follow God's instructions if I can't even handle these human instructions? And she kind of reflected for a second, and I think it gave her something more to think about. But it definitely improved our communication regarding it. And even my son kind of chimed in. He's in the back. He's hearing us go on. He's like, I think Daddy's right. He needs to do this or else he won't follow God's instructions. It was so cute to hear him like pipe up because we talk about that all the time, the importance of believing God's promises and following God's instructions. But it was something relatable, so I wanted to share it.
Yeah, well, of course, then you have to manage, not wielding your children against your spouse. Nonetheless, notice how comfortably the child will assume that. Right? I mean, that's why Jesus, he's got all of this tension he's feeling, But he says, but when all is said and done, I'll abide by the decision of my father. My inclinations are secondary to the father. See, so he has that very firmly. Yeah, but we have this interplay between, you know, two of the commandments. You know, a balance needs to be found. You've got the fifth commandment about honoring your father and your mother, but then there's that second commandment that Moses, you know, put in there for a very important reason. You know, because of humans' tendency to put anything and everything before God. Let the word graven become as metaphorical as it needs to be. You know, I mean, you know, you take it as far abstracted from just like literal carving, you know, as you need to, lest you put something, you know, as effectively a God above the God. You know, and so, again, the importance of seeing the wisdom in the commandments playing out in Jesus' young life. Oh, coincidentally, there's a commandment about that. Oh, coincidentally, there's a commandment about that. It's not like the Ten Commandments, you know, came out of nowhere. Right? I mean, they start with the seven commandments that were revealed to us, right? The Father's way, 500,000 years ago, and, you know, and then were augmented as need be to deal with humans living in a world of rebellion and default where, every which way of squirreling off on a tangent is in play.
Sure, yeah. Just for a quick cross-reference, I coincidentally was just over in paper 142 reading about Jesus talking to Flavius, this Greek proselyte of the gate who was wealthy and had a huge art collection. And I get the feeling that Jesus may have been hearkening back to some of his childhood experiences, because he talked to Flavius and he said, well, in paper 142, section 4, said, well, because Moses one time sought to combat idolatry and the worship of false gods, why should all men frown upon the reproduction of grace and beauty? And just quickly, as I was rereading that here just earlier today, I was thinking, you know, it's possible. It's easy to read that and say, well, he's affirming Flavius. You're not worshiping these objects. You're doing great. It's just a great art collection. What's the problem? But there's another way to look at it, that maybe Flavius was doing a little bit of idolatry and he was a proselyte of the gate, so he was really not fully all in on this stuff. And by Jesus just explaining why you shouldn't do that, by saying, surely you're not doing that, like maybe that convicted Flavius, because then he went out and got baptized. Maybe Jesus cleared some things up for the guy. Maybe he did have some false idols.
Yeah. And he wanted to do something, overtly manifest to demonstrate his purity of consecration. So yes, and then before we go on, we have to just delight in one of my favorite lines in the whole book. There it was, plain as day. It's just so hilarious. I could laugh at it 1,000 times. It's just so amazing. There it was.
Unbelievably idiomatic. It's midwayer as homespun grandmother lingo. Like it's very informal for their outside their average. Yeah.
When you look at that.
Plain as the nose on his face. My goodness.
It's an abomination.
Yeah.
It's funny, they know our language and our slang almost. Like, I mean, not that the slang, but it's like they've adapted some part of that culture and communicating that to us.
Yeah, but it's vivid. It's shorthand. We instantly all know exactly what they're talking about. So. And then before I hand the reading off, I just wanted to mention, I noticed the word committee showing up a couple of times in this paragraph, and I know I have an instinctive negative reaction to that. I thought, well, this is probably groupthink. This whole thing probably got out of hand because it's a bunch of elders each trying to upstage the other one, like, well, I think it's outrageous. Well, I think it's outrageous. And they're all, getting group thought up into a furor. But on the other hand, maybe not. Maybe this is actually some wisdom and tempering functioning, and give them credit. I mean, maybe this is just something that needed to happen because Jesus was going too far for the evolutionary process, it turned out. I don't know.
Yeah, and also remember that that commandment to honor your father and your mother, didn't begin as merely that. Like if you go back to Hap in the College of Revealed Religion, it was shall not show disrespect to your parents or to the elders of the tribe.
Yes. Right.
So those elders are a very important part of that initial faith submission predicate.
But he doesn't miss out the opportunity to kind of correct their thinking by saying that he will abide by the decision of his father in this, as in all other matters controversial. Like he's telling them, you got no business blaming this on the old man. I take full responsibility for what's going on here.
Yeah, but of course, as we pointed out, technically it is Joseph's fault. He's the one that's going to pay if someone's going to pay, because Jesus is too young yet.
Right.
Yeah.
He assumed responsibility for Jesus, as I said earlier in paper 123, I think. Some words to that effect.
Yeah.
Right. He's not subject to the law yet. But Joseph, is. So, but when they could see that Jesus, was very definitively putting it in Joseph's hands, the elders left. Yeah. But just, again, about that whole bit of the elders being in there, codified from the beginning in that commandment. But eventually, like you're getting at, Brad, you could have an issue where the potential for an individual to flower is getting squelched. So there has to be a balance, away from the external to the internal, as individuals evolve and are able to, take on the law in their hearts more, rather than having to have the law imposed from without. And so, you see that, evolving out. I mean, Melchizedek still had "you shall not show disrespect for your parents and elders."
He sure did.
But eventually, you kind of boil it down to that immediate first father parallel. Like I said, the lowercase f father, being the predicate for the capital F father and faith.
Yeah. All right. David, you want to take the reading?
Yes, sir. Mary endeavored to influence Joseph to permit Jesus to model in clay at home, provided he promised not to carry on any of these questionable activities at school. But Joseph felt impelled to rule the rabbinical interpretation of the second commandment should prevail. And so Jesus no more drew or modeled the likeness of anything from that day as long as he lived in his father's house. But he was unconvinced of the wrong of what he had done. And to give up such a favorite pastime constituted one of the great trials of his young life.
So there's that, that submission on Jesus's part, which is a very powerful part, but also the way they talk about Joseph. It doesn't say Joseph felt compelled. He felt impelled. Right? It's like no rationalization scheme, even yours, wife Mary, in the no rationalization scheme in the lower domain is going to overrule the upper domain. I'm impelled. I'm being driven into my inner domain. know, and that is going to be the final word here. And again, it doesn't matter, you know, if you know, the values are base or even false. Right? You know, there has to be some immutable, unquestioning foundation.
You know, there's a couple things I want to touch on briefly. Is the sequence of Hap's law, when you have law and order as the beginning of the journey, and then you're moving up into trust and faith in the third epical revelation, and love and service in the fourth epical revelation. That emphasis on the preeminence of the individual, that comes at the tail end of that sequence. It's not at the beginning. So there's a functionality to firmly establishing that law and order in regards to the elders having that influence in the trajectory of the culture due to their wisdom. And then a couple other things. I can't help but wonder, in Joseph seeing his son, Jesus's response to abiding by the fifth commandment, in his statement that he would abide by the decision of his father in this. When they got home and Mary endeavored to influence him to permit him to model clay at the house, you have to wonder if part of Joseph's awakening to being impelled to that rule was somewhat influenced by seeing his son's commitment to the fifth commandment.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I wanted to touch on, too, is what stands out to me the most in this in paragraph 5 was the, but he was unconvinced of the wrong of what he had done, and to give up such a favorite pastime constituted one of the great trials of his young life. To put that in context, there's two references in paper 2, section 7 that I'd like to share. One, they're both about art, and one, the first one I wanted to share is, all real beauty, material art, or spiritual symmetry is both true and good. And the second one that I wanted to share is, the great mistake of the Hebrew religion was its failure to associate the goodness of God with the factual truths of science and the appealing beauty of art. So there was an insight at the age of 9 that Jesus, in the depth of his heart, somehow knew he couldn't quite be convinced that there was something truly wrong in what he was doing. But yet he also had the clarity of abiding by his father's rule.
Yeah, and technically he wasn't even 9 yet. He was like, you know, 8 and a half.
Yeah, yeah, in July or whatever, yeah.
You know, it's in, you know, late winter here, so. Yeah, so,
oh,
yeah, I mean, but again, like I said, you know, it's, you know, one of the challenges of utilizing the fifth epical revelation as a template is the advanced nature of a lot of it. There's lots of statements in the revelation that are about not boxing yourself into just that mere born-again religious nucleus, but allowing there to be the liberty for the philosophic achievement. Like those passages you were reading. You know, but, you know, again, if you put that first, then you don't put first what Jesus told us to put first.
Yes.
Just reverencing, you know, is not going to get you into the kingdom. You have to have faith. So, first things first, you know, and Jesus is, you know, is being, framed by his experience into what should be first being first.
Yes.
Yeah. It may be the case that if that artistic endeavor hadn't gotten checked, he could have, you know, overplayed it, since he's so precocious and could be getting very adept at it at a very early age, it might have become his everything, and there you are with the second commandment again, having a false idol, putting art before God. So
I also see them like tipping
tricky.
The hat. Yeah, I see them tipping the hat a little bit here to the true scientific method as well, because it does not say that he was convinced of it being right. It says that he was unconvinced of it being wrong. In other words, the way we are supposed to examine any notion that we entertain in our mind against every word and paragraph throughout the fifth epical revelation to attempt to refute it instead of trying to rationalize, because as you say so many times, we could rationalize anything. But it's a tip of the hat that he's attempting to refute it in his mind, and he was unconvinced through his reflections that it was wrong. I mean, and to use the word wrong, I mean, it's like they're saying that he's using his second cosmic intuition here.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's you know, objectively, it's not wrong. It's yeah, six of one, half a dozen of another. It has nothing to do with such things. He just, you know, was diddling with charcoal on the floor. Okay. it doesn't have anything to do with right and wrong. But yeah,
but
like you're saying, there's a tendency to think in dichotomies, and it's like, you know, and to say, yeah, it's not wrong, it's right. No. Now you're putting that in place of God. You're not going to ascend into perfection of righteousness with that as your standard of goodness. So that's the key, right? And but there's a reactionary tendency. Someone telling you that something there's actually, you know, a whatever being wrong, you go, oh yeah, well I think it's right, rather than just, you know, recognizing it's an utterly neutral issue and irrelevant. You know that's self-righteousness. You know, what you favor, you declare to be right. See, it's a very sneaky thing that you have to watch. You know, I mean, because that is going to be your natural tendency. You know, instead of objectively, philosophically going, no, it's not wrong. It's you know, completely, and neutral. No, you'll go, oh, yeah? Well, I'm going to make it my God. I'm going to make it my everything, just so I can stick it in your face.
And it's even not what the elders were attempting to do, which was go by what they believe the group thought of as good. It's not doing that either.
All right. Meanwhile.
In the latter part of June, Jesus, in company with his father, first climbed to the summit of Mount Tabor. It was a clear day, and the view was superb. It seemed to this 9-year-old lad that he had really gazed upon the entire world, excepting India, Africa, and Rome.
You know, again, just this endless procession of vignettes like this of him very early on not getting boxed in a tiny little parochial viewpoint. It's just simple little things like climbing up, you know, Mount Tabor. You know, putting
the two
horizons back in his mind.
Even the fact that there's two uncles, one with a farm and one who likes to go fishing.
Yeah.
You know, I looked up Mount Tabor. Since, you know, Chris, you've inspired us all to try to slow down and have a little more precision. I've been spending more time with maps and, you know, the internet at my fingertips to say, well, what is this thing? And it's a very impressively shaped sort of lone round mountain by itself. And just quickly, like there was one of these, there's a geologic term for the kind of thing it is. There was one of these in my early adulthood outside of Austin, Texas, where I went to school. And even as a young adult, climbing it, there was something especially impressive about it. It made me take in the landscape in a different sort of way. I mean, Jesus climbed to the tops of a lot of hills, but I think Mount Tabor has got a different way about it. So it made me appreciate that. Would have really impressed a 9-year-old if it was like Enchanted Rock in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So.
We actually have a Mount Tabor here in Portland, Oregon, and we get together once a year and have a nice little potluck.
Do you also contemplate that you've gazed upon everything except India, Africa, and Rome?
No, but we do sometimes take a hike up to the top.
Wait a minute, what about North and South America? Out of sight, out of mind.
Jesus' second sister, Martha, was born Thursday night, September, 3 weeks after the coming of Martha. Joseph, who was home for a while, started the building of an addition to their house, a combined workshop and bedroom. A small workbench was built for Jesus, and for the first time he possessed tools of his own. At odd times, for many years, he worked at his bench and became highly expert in the making of yokes.
None of that graven image stuff, but you could get very precise in crafting wood artistically into a shape. So he found an outlet there that was acceptable. Now, you know, we have to mention in passing here, we only have six of the kids in play, but the pattern is already very suspicious, and those who know the revelation knows that this keeps up. You know, one of the most fascinating things about the offspring of Joseph and Mary is, you know, they came out in three sets of three, boy, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl. Very curious. It speaks to some kind of tighter intimacy with the cosmic over control of conception. Not going as far as like you see with Adam and Eve or Adam's and Errata, you know, where you get the, you know, kids in sets, you know, you get four and four and four, you know, where there's a dominant dominance, and then there's twins that are the two dominant recessives, and then you get a recessive recessive, and it repeats, right? You know, very extreme cosmic over control manifestation of procreation. But interesting, you know, hard to dismiss as coincidental pattern here of boy, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl.
It's also hard to notice as a pattern because I don't think we're set up to notice, to look for things like that, because everything in our culture tells us it's a random process. I guess every once in a while we'll notice when someone has like five boys and no girls. Like, well, that's weird. But I'd never noticed anything to see here, Chris, but thanks for pointing it out.
Yeah, it took me a while to sink in. It's like, wait a minute, you know, it's like, is that actually? And it's like, you know, it went back and I couldn't remember them all. Like, well, would you look at that?
And I'm sure they're not saying that Jesus was a comedian here, but can someone point out to me what a yoke is?
With two yoke of oxen and a big yeller dog. We all learned this in school when we were little kids, you know. No yoke.
This winter and the next were the coldest in Nazareth for many decades. Jesus had seen snow on the mountains, and several times it had fallen in Nazareth, remaining on the ground only a short time. But not until this winter had he seen ice. The fact that water could be had as a solid, a liquid, and a vapor, He had long pondered over the escaping steam from the boiling pots caused by the lad to think a great deal about the physical world and its constitution. And yet the personality embodied in this growing youth was all this while the actual creator and organizer of all these things throughout a far-flung universe.
Yeah, so just like when he's gazing up at the stars, and I commented, you know, basically that same little punchline there. But yeah, here it is again. It's like, oh man, that is like incredibly fascinating. There's three different phases of matter, and you know, what's up with that? And I mean, again, they just, it's just, you know, nonstop. You know, this scientific fascination and that one and that one and that one and that one.
You know, just briefly, I mentioned this on our podcast here on Symmetry of Soul. I had this experience with ice when I was about Jesus's age. It just got below freezing and I asked my parents, could I put some water outside? Because I heard it would change state. And it certainly was evocative and very interesting to me, but if I'm honest, I don't think that I was really reflective about it in the way this paragraph suggested. To me, I think I was, I got a sense that it was magical, that I just witnessed something enchanting. It was curious, but I don't think I was actually saying, three phases. All right. Well, why? I wonder why. I don't think I was quite there yet. Not at all as a 9-year-old where Jesus was.
Yeah, again, to just see the sophistication of his exercise of the first cosmic intuition.
Yeah. Not just observing how things behave and being, like I say, kind of entranced by it. The same thing happened at my workbench out in the garage when I ran electricity through water and saw hydrogen bubble off. But there was no reflective questions generated. I just sort of sat there and got hypnotized by the bubbles. I didn't go anywhere.
Yeah. So, you know, it's much more than the mere scientific impulse of the fourth adjutant. You know, he is strengthening it. Very definitively, with the first cosmic intuition.
Well stated. Good point.
Yeah, especially since they refer to it as he had long pondered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's always interesting too, looking at that they give us this tidbit about this being the coldest winter in Nazareth for many decades. Just the significance of that. Jesus wouldn't even be around for many decades, but they mentioned that fact.
Yeah, I think we might have mentioned it before. You start to become a little suspicious that the cosmos is in on this. Coincidentally, there's larger variations in the weather for the climate of Nazareth, than normal. So that coincidentally, Jesus gets even a more diverse stimulation. Yeah, it starts to get a little suspicious.
But
like I said, it's highly suspicious that it's boy, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl. I mean, it's like, wait a minute. I think the Supreme is in on this.
Well, yeah, I mean, just the impact that
it's
those children.
It's called
Providence. Yeah. The climate of Nazareth was not severe. January was the coldest month, the temperature averaging around 50 degrees Fahrenheit. During July and August, the hottest months, the temperature would vary from 75 degrees to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. From the mountains to the Jordan and the Dead Sea Valley, the climate of Palestine ranged from the frigid to the torrid. And so, in a way, the Jews were prepared to live in about any and all of the world's varying climates.
Okay, so besides giving us those details and how temperate Nazareth was because of, a little bit of elevations nearby, and of course the Mediterranean, nearby. But look at that, And then go, by the way, here, while we're mentioning that, coincidentally, the people that, quote-unquote, God chose, to be the instruments of spreading truth in the world, prior to Jesus, were prepared to live in about any and all of the world's varying climates. Again, see how I'm just throwing that in, like I'm saying, they're all but telling you, you should. Your suspicions are justified. That this isn't just a bunch of coincidences going on. There's plans also in play.
It kind of reminds me of that reference to the average man, that emphasis on the word average, and also when they talk about the genius of sort of this average mean point. I can't recall exactly how they phrased that, but there's something about that sweet spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, just Melchizedek missionaries went to the four corners and of the known world, and you can see they're hinting at the idea was that the Jews, if they hadn't dropped the ball, we're all primed to go to the four corners of the known world too. Just in terms of their climactic acclimation,
adaptability,
Even during the warmest summer months, a cool sea breeze usually blew from the west from 10 a.m. until about 10 p.m. But every now and then, terrific hot winds from the eastern desert would blow across all Palestine. These hot blasts usually came in February and March, near the end of the rainy season. In those days, the rain fell in refreshing showers from November to April, but it did not rain steadily. There were only two seasons in Palestine, summer and winter, the dry and rainy seasons. In January, the flowers began to bloom, and by the end of April, the whole land was one vast flower garden.
Yeah, so again, you got all these details, scientific details, the onshore breeze giving you that, the local prevailing winds. Touching upon, his fascination with botany that they mentioned, earlier, again, just pointing out how much stimulation there was to that end, as opposed to, I was born and raised out in the desert, right? The only green I see is that occasionally there's an oasis with a palm tree. Can you get a little closer to your mic?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Is that any different?
Yeah.
I think that's better.
Just try to get in tight because it was fading there.
Sounds good. In May of this year, on his uncle's farm, Jesus, for the first time, helped with the harvest of the grain. Before he was 13, he had managed to find out something about practically everything that men and women worked at around Nazareth, except metalworking. Spent several months in a smith shop when older, after the death of his father.
That last point we'll get to later on in our arc here. But again, it's just everything you can think of in terms of the diversity, and then the curiosity and the drive to mastery. To master himself in all ways.
Yeah, totally.
And they called him master.
When you touched upon the Melchizedeks in reference to the chosen people, the Jewish culture, I couldn't help but think about this reference from 77:2, where they talk about, it's pretty abstract, but they talk about the life carriers, I'll just read it. The life carriers had planned a new type of mortal, embracing the union of the conjoint offspring of the prince's staff with the first generation offspring of Adam and Eve. They had thus projected a plan envisioning a new order of planetary creatures whom they hoped would become the teacher rulers of human society. Such beings were designed for social sovereignty, not civil sovereignty. So I'm wondering, in this grand plan that didn't pan out, when the Melchizedeks are still attempting to keep that downstepped expression of that plan in play with the focusing in on this sort of chosen people idea, it's almost as if there's a second attempt to kind of keep the light moving and reinstitute the original plan, but with a lot less to work with.
Yeah, not just that particular plan, but, you know, I mean, normally there's a Princess Beth and there's the Adam and Eve regime. And right, I mean, the whole point is, you know, mankind on every world needs, you know, some sort of you know, kind of innately more immediate leader class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, so we aren't all wandering in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And that kind of takes us back to that commandment of following, listening to the elders. There's that same quality by having that social class in play that can kind of guide the rest of the bell curve.
Yeah, and it does take many, as they you know, they mentioned that spot, you know, in the Revelation. So, yeah, just, you know, it's an indispensable element to have some you know, guiding light on the world.
But even with it, with as much of this "you're not the boss of me" mentality that's developed in our
yep.
society, it's increasingly difficult.
Yep.
When work and caravan travel were slack, Jesus made many trips with his father on pleasure or business to nearby Cana, Endor, and Nain. Even as a lad, he frequently visited Sepphoris, only a little over 3 miles from Nazareth, to the northwest. And from 4 BC to about AD 25, the capital of Galilee, and one of the residences of Herod Antipas.
Now, and again, I mean, I can just kind of repeat it. I mean, you know, one paragraph after another. Oh, yeah, and there's this diversity and that diversity, and, you know, yeah, let's re-stress a diversity we mentioned before in a slightly different setting. It's, yeah, you know, they just keep pounding it. It becomes so obvious once you start, once you open your eyes to it. It's like, wow, they're wanting to make that point very clearly how important that is. And seeing how, you know, again, why that's so emphasized by the midwayers in this context, you know, the fifth epical revelation in contrast to the fourth. Okay. Because they're assuming that you have the fourth, that you're born again. And, you know, they're trying to give you a revelation that fosters, you know, that maturing to, you know, an adult of God and being born again, that philosophic attainment.
Right.
And how important it is. You know, you can't do that in some insular community.
Well, this paragraph has me thinking about all these offers Jesus kept getting to live in these giant metropolises, which, you know, these days we think of these big cities as cosmopolitan, a melting pot, whatever you want, but you know, elsewhere here in part four, they mentioned there were over 200 towns of 5,000 or more people in Palestine. Like, and each one of them is going to be a little different, and each one of them is going to have its own leadership. A lot of them are going to have their own synagogues. I think Jesus got a more diverse, variegated experience of just living, you know, day to day in a town, to say nothing of the caravans coming through, than he would have in a large city where, you know, you kind of wake up every day and just see a bunch of stone walls everywhere. And maybe you don't know your neighbors.
That's not Palestine. That's just Galilee.
Oh, that was just Galilee. Goodness. That's right. That's just Galilee. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. All these little hamlets, as we would say. Yeah.
You know, 30 or over 15,000.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Chris, you often mention about how they assume that we're born again when we come to the revelation. But I mean, I just wanted to speak briefly about how masterly this book was constructed, because someone like me who wasn't born again, who had no knowledge of the Bible or religion, was able to come into it. Of course, I came into it like most do. I discovered the love of God, had no concept of the law of God, but through a genuine hunger and curiosity, I was able to encounter you and was able to realize on a different level, you know, what this book is. And so, like, I just want to say that I believe that people can come to it even without that and still find their way.
Yeah, my point is just, you know, so many things in it are based upon that predicate, right?
Yeah.
It's like, why do I need a paragraph about the temperature variations when I'm trying to get to my spiritual birth?
You didn't check the course prerequisites.
Why do I need to know all those details about ultimatonic motions? And everything, but see, so much of it, you know, the reason that it's as big as it is and covers so many topics as it is not because it's a religious text.
Yeah.
A religious text, you know, just a mere religious text is fostering someone to be born again. A philosophic text like this, I mean, has that, but so much more.
Right.
Yeah.
Has to.
Yeah. The philosophic text encompasses a religious text and a scientific text, transcendently encompasses them.
Mm-hmm.
It has to.
Yeah.
Justin, would you like to take over reading?
Sure. Thanks, David.
Of course.
Jesus continued to grow physically, intellectually, socially, and spiritually. His trips away from home did much to give him a better and more generous understanding of his own family, and by this time, even his parents were beginning to learn from him as well as to teach him. Jesus was an original thinker and a skillful teacher, even in his youth. He was in constant collision with the so-called oral law, but he always sought to adapt himself to the practices of his family. He got along fairly well with the children of his age, but he often grew discouraged with their slow-acting minds. Before he was 10 years old, he had become the leader of a group of 7 lads who formed themselves into a society for promoting the acquirements of manhood, physical, intellectual, and religious. Among these boys, Jesus succeeded in introducing many new games and various improved methods of physical recreation.
Jesus was a Boy Scout.
There's a lot in that paragraph. We could talk endlessly, just, you know, like that last part, how much that's, you know, speaking to the present circumstances of society. But, you know, a couple of points. I mean, you know, in that first line, you know, physically, intellectually, socially, and spiritually, right, more and more, right, there's personality management, the spiritually part. Like the amount of personality management it took for him to deal with the whole graven image situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Physically, intellectually, socially, he's not going to do it there.
Well, even
personality management, you know, development to handle that.
Even the fact that the society that he's promoting in regarding manhood is physical, intellectual, and religious.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And of course. Yeah. The key part of it, you know, in terms of the society is the religious part. You know, that will conserve the society. I mean, the physical part will, you know, protect it from invaders, but the religious part will conserve it, you know, so it doesn't commit suicide, you know, independent of raiders. You know, and then, of course, right in the middle, you know, we mentioned it a minute ago. I can't remember which one you guys mentioned it. You know, but he always sought to adapt himself to the practices of his family. He's discovering the meaning of life, its adaptability.
Adaptability, yeah.
Huh. That's amazing how consistent this text is across hundreds of pages. But of course it is. It's a revelation. Yeah.
And again, notice how I said it. He didn't discover the meaning of life. Adapting, no. Right? It's that sought to adapt, see? He's discovering, wait a minute. I have adaptability. I have this potential. And so I can seek to adapt. I can seek to actualize that potential. Wow, that gives my life meaning.
And so much of this paragraph is focused on that quality of associativity. You have both intellectual and socially, and then right after that, you have this reciprocal associativity between the parents learning from him and him learning from the parents, and then you have this direct reference to their slow-acting minds, and we know that in terms of individuality, associativity, and unity, the associativity part is in reference to mind. So it's almost like the whole paragraph is kind of helping you zoom in on that adaptability.
Not to mention, he's beginning to recognize, wow, did I get a lucky roll of the dice on parents? A more generous understanding of his own family.
Yeah.
I'm looking at some of these other kids' parents, and oh, boy. I take back any negative thoughts I had about my parents.
All right, section 2, the 10th year, A.D. 4. It was the 5th of July, the first Sabbath of the month, when Jesus, while strolling through the countryside with his father, first gave expression to feelings and ideas which indicated that he was becoming self-conscious of the unusual nature of his life mission. Joseph listened attentively to the momentous words of his son, but made few comments. He volunteered no information. The next day, Jesus had a similar but longer talk with his mother. Mary likewise listened to the pronouncements of the lad, but neither did she volunteer any information. It was almost 2 years before Jesus again spoke to his parents concerning this increasing revelation within his own consciousness regarding the nature of his personality and the character of his mission on earth.
Yeah, so just quickly there, see, notice right in the midway point, between 8 and 12 here, this phase, the fact that the thought changer is at work, he's beginning to have his moral consciousness of, the values of that moral consciousness translated from the material, the human, and the temporal to the spiritual, the divine, and eternal, and, on that basis, he's beginning to have some awareness of the transcendent nature of his personality. So, just notice that they're marking that at the midway point of this, of the 8 to 12 phase.
This is we probably can't go too deep into this, but a quick question. Do you think that the mechanism of his material mind, his conscious mind, in gaining a deeper understanding regarding the nature of his personality and the character of his mission on earth, do you think that was basically communicated almost entirely through that interplay with the adjuster and his superconscious with his conscious?
No, it's not an interplay with the adjuster. It's just, like I said, it's just merely, he's beginning to reciprocate his, the foundation of his mind. He's starting to get his feet planted in eternity instead of in time. Just that simple fact, the adjuster is often in the distance in terms of any conscious awareness or anything like that. It's just that reciprocally, that's what that thought changer is reciprocating you from having your feet planted in time to planted in eternity. And you plant Jesus's feet in eternity, and it's like, wait a minute, I was born in eternity, right? Okay, he's not thinking that, right? But that's a reality. And he begins to get a sense, there's something transcendent about me being here. Don't know what it is. I'm going to mention my suspicions to Mom and Dad. mum's the word from them. All right, well, let's see if we can
get a couple
more paragraphs in here.
He entered the advanced school of the synagogue in August. At school, he was constantly creating trouble by the questions he persisted in asking. Increasingly, he kept all Nazareth in more or less of a hubbub. His parents were loath to forbid his asking these disquieting questions, and his chief teacher was greatly intrigued by the lad's curiosity, insight, and hunger for knowledge.
So notice that this teacher isn't just some simplistic, moralist. I mean, you can see that this teacher is a teacher for a reason, and is being stimulated by, this scientific curiosity and all this hunger for knowledge. So there's that, and then, Jesus is this one endless giant rock in the pond here, more or less of a hubbub. That hubbub starts within yourself if you begin to make the journey upward. You're going to put all of your preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices in turmoil.
Hmm. And that's not just a platitude. That's for real.
Yeah.
Jesus' playmates saw nothing supernatural in his conduct. In most ways, he was altogether like themselves. His interest in study was somewhat above the average, but not wholly unusual. He did ask more questions at school than others in his class.
And again, just pointing out, like one of you were saying about that, it's the kind of the normal individual that has the greatest potential. But what is activating? It's the questions. They just keep coming back to that. It's an active and questioning self. We're talking about a human and not a fancy animal. We're talking about someone who can't be replaced by a sophisticated AI program.
Right.
The more that we have sophisticated AI programs and go, wow, I couldn't have written something that, that beautiful. Yeah, see, that's a fancy animal recognizing he's being trumped by a fancier animal. Now, what about a human? What is a human like?
I find myself, in the last minute here, just wondering, what does a classroom look like when it's filled with children who all received as fortunate of an upbringing as Jesus, as it would on a more advanced, normal world? The teaching would be completely different. I mean, today, if we tried to do that, if that would happen tomorrow, the class would be utterly disrupted. It'd be nothing but questions. Like, your whole pedagogy would have to be different. Maybe instruction would be different. Different world.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's also just that, nothing supernatural. Like I mentioned, there's a few spots where they try to disabuse us of some of our fairy tales about Jesus's magical childhood.
Yeah, the last thought I wanted to share is on those lines, too, is the fact that his playmates saw nothing supernatural and that he was altogether like themselves, and at the same time, his teacher was greatly intrigued by the lad's curiosity, insight, and hunger for knowledge. He had this capacity to find this balance in not standing out too much to where he's ostracized by his peers, but yet still being genuine in his search, his thirst.
Again, it's not about having a lot of just raw horsepower. It's about taking what you have and actually doing something with it.
Yeah.
As the song goes, I will take my life into my hands and I will use it. All right. We'll end on a 1960s song lyric. Why not? Let's do that. It was a fantastic study. Thanks for joining us. I hope to see you back here again next Tuesday as we continue to read about this aggressive and precocious child who's also the creator of our universe. Follow the way.
God bless you, everyone.
Take care, everyone.
Yep. Love you all. Join us back again next Tuesday, and we'll sally forth some more. Love you all. Bye now.